Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East. The very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.
This podcast is part of the Grand Embassy Productions. Hello, comrades, and welcome to Tsar Power. I'm Roberto.
And I'm Aurora, and together we're ranking the Russian rulers from Rurik to Putin to see who gets to party it out in the Kremlin or get shipped off to the Gulag. This week, we are still on our first Prince of Vladimir Suzdal, ruler number 26, Andrei Bogolyubsky.
And we are ending Andrei today, no matter how long it takes.
We're locked in.
We're locked in. We're loaded. We're good to go. But because I like to do one ad per ruler, Kingdom, the Swedish Rexipod, is getting another ad. So here you go. Have fun, Chris and Elsa.
Hello, we're Orsa and Chris from the podcast of Flatpak History of Sweden, now with our brand new podcast called Kingdom.
We're ranking all the Swedish kings, queens, and regents in a number of categories to see how interesting or great they are. We'll look at how successful they were in battle, if they moved the country forward or not, and of course, if they got up to any crazy or raunchy madness during their reign.
In the end, we'll decide if they're interesting, influential, or maybe just weird enough to be awarded the three crowns. Or, the opposite, they should meet their fate in our meatball grinder. See you there.
Well, that's the second time we heard that today.
Hey, it's still good.
Oh yeah, no, it's such a great show. I'm enjoying it. They just released a law and order of the Swedish rulers.
Mm-hmm.
So how does the law work? And of course, they did it for their other show, which is also on Sweden. So it's like, hey, easy peasy.
Get a primer already.
So speaking of rules, we actually got a donation to the show. We got the Domostroy Rules for Russian Households in the Time of Ivan the Terrible from a fan.
Oh, hell yeah.
Yes. So thank you to Aloise H. Verhagen. That sounds Dutch. So I'm going to say Verhagen.
Thank you to the Kingdom of the Netherlands.
Thank you, Aloise, if you are Dutch. And if you are not, I'm sorry, but it sounds Dutch.
Maybe you're Belgian. That's also a possibility.
And also thanks to our Patreon members who have been as amazing as always with their continued support. This show couldn't run without you. So thank you to Audrey Neeson, Andrew Schneider, Mitchell Dutt, Eric Nicholson, Hallie Kuntz, Ari Tena, Hal the Legionnaire, Emily Bavona, Quinn Campagna, David Montgomery, Konstantine Megrilishvili, Gracie D, Marcus Aurelius, and Daniel Bowline. You guys are all amazing. We value each and every one of you. So thank you.
Thank you so much.
And if you want to join them, you can hop on Patreon and support us there. On the $5 tier, you get our bonus episodes. We are currently in the midst of releasing episodes on Russian cursing. So part one is already out, which is Russian curse words. And part two is all the phrases that we did afterwards.
I learned so much. I'm much more cultured now, thanks to that.
All I remember from that episode is that Anna and I were just giggling like crazy the whole time.
Yeah, because neither one of you could like read one of them to Trip and I without breaking into schoolgirl giggles.
Well, you know, that's what happens.
Episode two coming out is even better because we managed to teach Anna a few English sort of cursed phrases as well. So it was a real cultural exchange.
Oh, for sure. So you have that to look forward to, and eventually Pushkin Part 3, whenever that happens.
Someday.
I love how I made the Ministry of Culture like, oh, we're going to go through these all these people and get through them, and we're still on Pushkin, but he's a big guy.
He's a busy man. All right.
One last thing. We do have a merch store now, so if you want your own branded Zarbucks logo on either a cup or a sticker, you can do that. There's currently a 10% discount until the end of 2025, so go to zarpower.com to purchase it. Now I'm ready. Aurora, do you remember what happened last episode?
Yeah, we had to do a rehash of all the times Yuri and his various nemesis traded the throne of Kiev back and forth.
It's never ending. I can't wait for it.
And all of Andrei's older brothers had to die.
Yes, mysteriously, somehow.
Hunting accidents. None of them died in a hunting accident, but they know that's the trope, so.
Well, it's in the Tsar Power lore. Andrei killed his older siblings in hunting accidents.
They need to stop scheduling hunting activities for stress relief.
How will you show your manliness, Aurora?
You know, it's been a few years since I worried about doing that, so I'm not sure.
I didn't mean you. But just a bit of a note. If you haven't listened to part one, go back now.
Yes, please.
This is your last warning.
Absolutely. This is one where you have to do part one before part two.
So let's get started. Officially, almost 10 minutes in. We last saw Andrei taking control of the princedoms of Rostov and Suzdal. While he ruled over this land, Andrei would become much loved by the people due to his virtue, his piety, and all the charity work that he did. He would also take the time to build many monasteries, churches, and give the religious estates land and adorn them lavishly. Andrei was also noted for how much he enjoyed reading scripture and the respect he held amongst the clergy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Aurora, there is a lot going on in Andrei's life, so we're going to be compartmentalizing his life just a little bit.
Okay.
So we're going to start off with the expansion of the city of Vladimir and all the religious things that Andrei did, because it doesn't make sense to have them interspersed throughout the narrative when we can do it all in one go. Just for the sake of, like, narratively, he's doing religious things, and narratively, he's doing fighty things.
Okay, sure. Vladimir and religion.
Despite the love that the people of Rostov and Suzdal had for Andrei, it was the boyars of both cities that got on Andrei's nerves. To separate himself from the boyars, Andrei decided that he would build up the city of Vladimir instead. In doing so, he laid the foundation of a grand fortress, or a Kremlin, in the city of Vladimir, alongside the foundation for the Cathedral of the Dormition of the Most Pure Theotokos.
These boyars are annoying me. I'm going to go build my own city with blackjack, except not because I'm religious.
With icons and incense.
With icons, yeah. Screw you guys. I'm going to start my own city with icons and incense.
Once these foundations were completed, Andrei would move his capital from Suzdal over to Vladimir. This would not be enough distance, though, and as the court followed him to Vladimir, he would make a new palace complex outside the city named Bogolyubova, which was named after him.
Yeah, that was the name that the locals started calling it, right?
Exactly, because it's basically like his palace, essentially.
The palace of the pious.
Yeah. So Bogolyubova is located just northwest of Vladimir.
Also, don't ask me to say that.
That's fine. Here, Andrei would lavishly adorn the churches he had built, exceeding the beauty of churches anywhere else, and he would also place the icon of the Most Holy Theotokos that he had spirited away from his father within the church with the jewel-encrusted frame that he had built for it. To add to that, he built another church in Vladimir, the Church of the Savior. With the city now completed, Andre wanted to ensure that he could bring the necessary prestige needed to Vladimir and to establish his own metropolitan see to rival that of Kiev. But this was not without its own controversy, and it's time for the drama regarding the religious life of the city of Vladimir.
Let's do it.
What kind of drama do you think this is going to be, Aurora?
If it's drama about the religious life, it's going to be priestly. We're going to have arguing over which priest is in charge of things and whether they're more aligned with, like, whoever's more aligned with Kiev or aligned with Constantinople or something, right? Like, it's going to be some weird religious infighting among priests.
Are you reading my script?
No. I just know how these work.
I'll say, like, you're pretty much on the ball there, but let's see who's actually involved here and how they're involved.
Well, also, we had this same fight, sort of, with some previous rulers. I forget which rulers it was, but, like, one of them installed a new, you know, like, a new head of the church that was, like, more aligned with the locals. One said wanted a head of the church was more aligned with Byzantium, and then there was, like, a whole fight about that previously. So I figured that was still an ongoing debate.
Yes, yes. But not relating to Andre, because this is up in his city now.
Okay. I just meant, I guess that was the feud, because it seems like a type of schismy feud that the church would continue to have.
Mm-hmm. Well, we start our story out with the Bishop of Rostov in 1157, who went by the name of Nestor. See, Nestor did something that Andre was not very happy with. Can you guess?
Took communion the wrong way.
No, that was fine so far. As far as we know.
Venerated the wrong icon.
No. You get one more.
I don't know. Give service to the wrong other, like, lord or duke.
Well, the thing that made Andre so unhappy was that Nestor did not allow meat to be eaten on the Lord's Feast on Wednesdays and Fridays, with the exception only being on Christmas and the Epiphany.
Oh, meatless Wednesdays and Fridays.
Yes. While this was the canonical position of the Patriarch of Constantinople, Nestor would be seen as too conservative in the Suzdalian lands.
Okay.
This led Nestor to be kicked out of the city by Andre, and the following year, the Metropolitan of Kiev sent a bishop named Leon to replace Nestor. This did not go well for Leon, because in the Suzdalian lands, his appointment as bishop was considered illegal, and is quoted by the Suzdalian monks as having seized Nestor's throne.
Uh-huh.
And this is quite interesting, because he was appointed directly by the Metropolitan of Kiev, who overlooks everyone in the Rus lands. And to add some gasoline to the fire, Leon's first year did not go well, as there was a severe famine in Rostov, followed by a fire which destroyed the cathedral in the city.
So we've illegally kicked out the bishop, put in a new guy that nobody likes, and in his first year there's a famine and a fire. The mandate of heaven is not with Leon.
Absolutely. And his luck didn't end there, because in 1160, he would be expelled by the boyars and clergymen of Rostov because he had enlarged church authority and robbed the priests as well.
Yeah, that'll do it.
To be honest, all that Leon did was conduct an inventory of the churches under his domain to ensure that they were meeting the episcopal tax that they had to pay.
Hey, look, forcing people to pay the taxes that they owe but is considered by those people theft.
Well, in doing so, he also included all the altars that were in each church, which would increase the size of his episcopal treasury.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, there may have been some greed on his part, because he didn't have to do all of that. But he was still in charge, and he couldn't be kept out for long if Andre wanted him to be there.
Boss man still got his back.
Until Leon went on to the opposite extreme compared to his predecessor Nestor. Leon began to preach that meat eating should not be permitted for any of the Lord's Feast, extending it to even Christmas and the Epiphany.
Ho-ho-ho.
Looks like meat's off the menu, boys.
Meat's back off the menu, boys.
With this change in thought, Leon would soon be seen as heretical for not even allowing meat on feasting days, which is allowed canonically. You can eat meat on feast days, but he's like, no, you can't. And he came into direct opposition with the Patriarch of Constantinople.
Okay, well, if you're in opposition of Andre and the Patriarch, you're probably not going to end up doing well for yourself.
Mm-hmm. This did not sit well with Andre, and while Leon worked to defend everything that he was preaching, the Prince of Suzdal and the boyars were disgusted with him entirely, and now fully expelled him from the land. Leon would wander around the land, heading to Chernigov to meet with Sviatoslav Ogrovich of episode 24.5 fame, and then off to Kyiv. Once in Kyiv, Leon would speak with the Metropolitan, who would then rebuke him for his heretical teachings. Offended at how he was treated for his thoughts of going vegan and telling everyone about it, Leon decided to go to the big boss, the Patriarch of Constantinople, to get his support. Once Leon got to the Roman capital, he would promptly be imprisoned for his heresy.
Real, I want to talk to the boss energy, and the boss is like, no, they told you right the first time.
Leon would return back to Rus a few years later, but he would be expelled and have his position removed immediately.
Amazing.
Everywhere he went, he'd be seen as a heretic, and he would die a decade later, left destitute and bitter, condemned as a heretic.
Such is the fate that awaits us all.
But we're not done yet, Aurora, because all these events lead us to a new bishop of Rostov named Fyodor Yets.
Okay. New name alert.
Or Theodore, because Fyodor is just Theodore.
So what's Teddy? What's Teddy like?
Well, around this time, Andrei would meet with his new bishop, princes, and boyars, addressing them as thus. The city of Vladimir was founded by the holy and blessed Vladimir, who gave it his own name. This Vladimir enlightened the entire Russian land with holy baptism, and now I, a sinful and unworthy one, thanks to the divine grace and with the help of the most pure Theotokos, have enlarged it and elevated it as much as I could. And I have built there a church in honor of the most pure Theotokos and her venerable Assumption. I have adorned and endowed it with possessions and wealth, with districts and towns, and I have apportioned a tithe of every weekly market and a tenth of the herds of cattle. And from everything I have given tithes to the Lord God and to the most pure Theotokos. Therefore, I would like to establish a metropolitan see in this city, so that the city may be the capital of the Grand Principality and the head city of the entire land.
Oh, he wants a see there so that he can make Vladimir the most prominent city in all of Rus.
Exactly. You can see this is starting to like come up in mind, right?
Mm-hmm. He's starting to think, what if Kyiv wasn't the most important place on the map? What if I made my place the most important place on the map?
What if I just became the problem?
What if I declared that I'm important?
Like father, like son. With this speech, they all gave an exclamation of approval, wanting to give their new capital much more religious power than Kyiv. They then sent an ambassador to the Patriarch of Constantinople so he could make a new metropolitan see in Vladimir. Once in the Byzantine capital, the Vladimirian ambassador went on and on about the benefits of creating a new see, and the patriarch listened intently. And then you could see a small bubble coming from his mouth, anime style. The patriarch needed time to think about this, and after a few days, he sent a letter to the ambassador, who returned with it to the Prince of Vladimir. Now, I could read this long letter, but it was 30 pages.
Good lord.
And Aurora, you'd probably kill me.
Let me guess, it's a super long 30-page document that at the end says no.
Yes, how'd you know?
Because otherwise there wouldn't need to be 30 pages of explanations.
I actually even have a little thing. It's like, oh yeah, it's a big red stamp that says request denied. you got me. Well, as you mentioned, below all those pages were pages and pages of his reasoning as to why Andrei shouldn't have a metropolitan see. And it was because of one person, actually.
The current metropolitan of Kyiv?
No. Who's the new bishop?
Teddy?
It's because of Teddy.
Teddy.
We don't even know about him. He's already causing issues.
Andre up there like, well, no one rid me of these troublesome metropolitans.
Well, you see, the patriarch's issue with Teddy is that he was never consecrated as a bishop. And was therefore not legally allowed to be the religious administrator of Vladimir, Suzdal, and Rostov. In the patriarch's eyes, he was only a bishop-elect because Andrei supported him. Also, Teddy wasn't actually doing what he was supposed to be doing. Firstly, he followed no monastic principles and did not respect his fellow monks, despite calling himself one.
Good start.
He also never observed the rule of celibacy that was in place for bishops and was actively married. He's also a monk. He can't be married.
Yeah, well, oh, come on. Who hasn't had a spouse or two when you're not supposed to?
And he also allowed for all sorts of food to be eaten, even during fasting days, which was a complete opposite of what Nestor and Leon had been doing previously. We went from You can fast, except for some days. You're always fasting, too. Who has to fucking fast? And worst of all, Teddy was actively seen as a major bully. This was because he was physically strong, and that strength brought out in him an inherent sense of arrogance and cruelty, which led him to be extremely severe when dealing with the clergy who did not support his rather heretical teachings. If no priest agreed with him, he'd force the closure of their churches.
All right, yeah, that is bully behavior. All right.
Yeah. Therefore, the patriarch had to deny Andre's request because Andre had forced out Leon and Nestor, who, despite not being fully agreeable with Andre, were the actual bishops of Rostov and Suzdal. So, in sum, the patriarch's refusal was to defend Leon and Nestor's ousting by Andre and also punishing Andre for Teddy's heresy and lack of celibacy. This response obviously disheartened Andre. So, Aurora, what do you think Andre did for the sake of creating his metropolitan see? Remember, he's known as the Pious.
Replaced Teddy with a different archbishop.
So here's what Andre did. He ignored the patriarch's response and kept Teddy as his bishop.
Amazing.
You know, gotta keep the guy who lets you eat meat on every day.
Yeah, well, you know, sometimes the best thing you can do is just ignore your boss.
Yeah. A few years after this, Rostov would have a large fire rage through it, burning most of it down, including a wooden church, the most pure Theotokos. This is not the one that had the icon in it that he stole.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know that because we still got that one around, so.
Yeah, and that one's in Vladimir, so it's fine. Andre could not have that church remain gone, so instead of building a new wooden one, he had it built in stone. And while digging up the foundations for this new church, the workers discovered the bodies of several bishops of Rostov who were untouched by the flames, and they exuded a sweet fragrance.
Mm-hmm.
These bodies were declared holy relics, and they were placed in the stone church after it was completed. Not long after this, the Golden Gates, which were the main entryway into Vladimir, and made in the style of the ones in Kiev, were consecrated, and there was a small altar above them. Years after the city of Vladimir was denied having a metropolitan see, Teddy's actions began to really weigh on him. So, he decided to go to Constantinople in 1170, after the sack of Kiev, and present himself to the Patriarch. After greeting the Patriarch, Teddy went on and on about how the Metropolitan of Kiev had actually died in the sack, which he didn't, we're going to cover this in a bit, and that instead, he, Teddy, should be made the new Metropolitan of Kiev.
Okay.
How do you think the Patriarch responded?
I'm going to go with the big old rejection stamp again.
Yes, because the Patriarch did not believe him, because he essentially said, the Kievan monks would tell me if he were actually dead. And, you know, he was already having issues with Teddy's behavior anyways, so why would he want to support him?
He's like, I already don't like you. Why would I give you even more stuff that you want?
So, being denied this opportunity, Teddy asked to be made the official Bishop of Rostov instead, like actually getting consecrated. The Patriarch sighed and was like, ah, fine, if this gets you away from me. And especially since Teddy has been the bishop in all but name, thanks to Andre's support, over the last few years. So it's like, all right, it's official now. Bye. Leave me alone.
Okay, here. You're consecrated. Whatever. Get.
On his return to Rostov, Teddy went to see Andre and let him know that he had been officially made the bishop of Rostov. Andre did not believe Teddy, citing that he had heard nothing from the Metropolitan of Kiev and that he should get the Metropolitan's blessing to ascend to that seat.
The Metropolitan that Teddy tried to claim was dead.
Yes. Teddy obviously wanted nothing to do with the Metropolitan, and instead mentioned that he had been placed there at the Patriarch's behest. With this information, Andre finally agreed to let Fyodorets do whatever he wanted, and Andre would offer his advice from time to time. However, Teddy's arrogance compelled him to not listen to anything the Grand Prince of Vladimir was saying.
Mm-hmm.
So, as we mentioned before, Teddy would use his newfound power to continue closing church services when the priest didn't agree with him, and now he started misappropriating the donations given to the church, taking it for himself, not even keeping it for the bishopric as Leon had done. Teddy would go as far as to even take the possessions of many of the princes and boyars that he enjoyed seeing, and if those princes and boyars complained, Teddy would imprison and torture them.
Torture, a good thing for bishops to be doing, I think.
For instance, Teddy made an example out of a rich chamberlain who complained about Teddy and sent a massive amount of insults his way. Aurora, you can decide what some of the insults were.
Oh, I mean, it's got to be one of the classic medieval insults, right? that his mother was some sort of various rodent. His father smelt like some sort of plant, you know, the usual.
Your mother was a hamster and your father smelt of elderberries.
Exactly.
Well, in response to this, Teddy ordered the Chamberlain be crucified upside down.
Holy, all right.
The rest of the princes and boyars that he'd place into prison and torture them, he would begin by burning their heads, beards, and eyes with candles. And once he grew bored of that, he would nail their tongues, noses, and ears, and lips to the wall or different wooden boards.
Yeah, okay, that's pretty horrifying.
For some, he would grab a sword and start hacking them to pieces right there on the ground.
Okay.
Now, if the noble happened to be a woman, yeah.
Oh, God.
He'd capture them and rape them.
Of course.
And then boil them alive. What a holy man!
Sure.
All of this he did to just take their possessions. He's great, isn't he?
This is a great guy.
Yeah.
Old Teddy.
Yep. The boyars, princes, and people had had enough of Teddy by this point, and they marched up to Andre, weeping bitterly about the abuse that they were facing under Teddy.
Mm-hmm.
Andre was perturbed by what he had heard, as if he had never heard what Teddy had been doing before.
Yeah.
And he called to his bishop, saying, "Oh, the people grieve and weep. You have closed all your churches, and there are no services in them. And you have even locked up the miraculous icon of the most pure Theotokos." Well, Teddy in his arrogance would not listen to Andre, and sent him a verbal assault laced with profanity and blasphemy directed to the most holy Theotokos.
Alrighty.
Well, Andre could take being verbally assaulted by a bishop with ease. However, when Teddy turned to blasphemy against the most holy Theotokos, he could no longer defend his bishop. Not even the, "Oh yeah, you're killing people and murdering and raping them and then boiling them alive." No, you insulted the most holy Theotokos.
Insert the, "You can excuse this, but not this" meme here.
Yeah. Andre ordered Teddy to be arrested and sent to Kiev. There, the Metropolitan ordered that Teddy's actions be investigated. The whole time Teddy was imprisoned, he would not shut up and continue to go on about how he did nothing wrong, laced with profanity, blasphemous language against God and the Theotokos. With that, the Metropolitan of Kiev asked that Teddy repudiate everything he had said. What do you think Teddy said?
"I apologize for nothing."
No, that's too nice of a way. He was arrogant about it.
I forget. Do we swear on the show? I forget.
We do.
Tell him to go fuck himself.
Go fuck yourself and the Holy Mary you rode in on. Well, with a heavy heart, the Metropolitan of Kiev ordered Teddy executed as a blasphemer.
Finally.
On his execution day, Teddy had his tongue cut out for his heresy alongside his right hand, and his eyes were plucked out. While still living, a millstone was attached to his neck, and he was cast into the sea to drown.
All right.
This was a customary punishment in Byzantium for blasphemers, which is where the Metropolitan of Kiev was from. And that is it for religious life in Andre's reign. He was able to build up churches and his cities, but struggled to keep his bishop in check.
So he built a bunch of churches, but every bishop he got was terrible.
Yeah, and you know what the common thing was?
What?
He basically put them in, except for Nestor.
Yeah, he picked them all, and they were all terrible.
You know, he didn't pick Nestor. He just kicked out Nestor, because Nestor was actually following the law. It's like, no, you can't eat meat on Wednesdays and Fridays, unless it's like a feast day. Other than that, you're fasting. And it's like, no, I want to eat meat.
And because he wanted to eat meat so bad, he made life worse for everyone.
Yes.
I'm not going to insert the lesson here.
There is no lesson.
Lesson is eat less meat. Make life better for all your boyars.
Right.
Actual reign.
Now, aside from the religious struggles that Andre faced, most of which were caused by his strategy of placing inept or horrible bishops in Rostov and Vladimir, Andre actually presided over the Vladimir Suzdal land. And we're going to go back in time, because we ended up in around 1170. We're going to go all the way back to the 1150s, you know, when his dad died.
Mm-hmm.
And he would soon go on campaign against the Volga Bulgarians in an effort to protect his own borders from their incursions. Now, what do you think these Volga Bulgarians are?
Bulgaria?
See,
no, it's like This is like north or something like that. Like, it's not where you think they would be.
No, they're on the Volga River within like the borders of Russia.
Oh, okay. Okay.
They're like around modern day Kazan in the steppe region.
Oh, you're right. Yeah, you're right.
Because
you're right.
The Bulgarians essentially had two different groups in two different areas. So you had them in Bulgaria, and those are the ones that turned Slavic. And then you had the ones in the steppe region, which remained kind of Turkic.
That makes sense.
So there's two different groups. So when I say Volga Bulgarians, it's the ones in Russia, not the ones in Bulgaria.
Gotcha.
Yes. However, Andrei couldn't do this alone, and he would enlist the help of one of the most powerful people that he knew. We've mentioned their name a few times today.
Byzantines.
Nope. It's actually the most pure Theotokos.
Oh, God.
Because Andrei brought out the icon that he had stolen from his father on campaign with him.
Oh, yeah, that'll do it.
Alongside two crosses as well. So before battle, he had a shrine set up to the most pure Theotokos. And he would fall before the icon and crosses and pray to them for safety and victory against his enemies. And his boyars would soon follow him in prayer.
Yeah, a strategy just about as old as Christendom and government, praying directly before battle with a giant cross.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks, Constantine.
With the prayer now complete, Andrei and his army marched against the Volga Bulgarians, and they were able to capture five of the cities, alongside much treasure that he held back with them. Those that saw Andrei and his troops saw the icon of the most pure Theotokos floating behind them, emanating flaming rays which illuminated the whole army in a holy glow, leaving the prince's enemies trembling with awe. He ordered the Bulgar cities that he captured to be razed to the ground, and he imposed tribute on remaining cities in the area. With that, Andrei would return back to Vladimir and lay the foundation for his new Kremlin.
Oh, got me a bunch of loot. Time to build a Kremlin.
Oh, yeah. A couple of years later, Izaslav III, who we covered in his own episode, would approach Andrei in order to arrange the marriage of his nephew to the daughter of Andrei. The thing is that Izaslav III was attempting to retake the throne of Kiev from the Grand Prince Rostislav I, who we also covered. He's the manager,
mm-hmm.
who was Izaslav II's brother. This would allow Andrei to showcase his support for the Chernigov prince when the time came. Once Izaslav III called for Andrei, Andrei would send his own son.
Izaslav.
You're damn right. to aid the prince of Chernigov. The addition of the Vladimir Suzdal forces bolstered the prince of Chernigov's army and allowed Izaslav III to win the day, take the throne, and let Andrei's son Izaslav return home.
Ah, so Andrei was helping out. What, the son of his dad's, like, mortal enemy, right?
No.
No, the guy that possibly killed his dad, right?
Yes.
He's helping out the guy who possibly had his dad killed.
Yeah.
All right.
So, Aurora, there's a city we haven't talked about in a while.
Moscow.
No, not Moscow.
Well, we hadn't talked about that in a bit. Kyiv.
No, we've talked about Kyiv. It's an unruly city. They're always causing issues.
Oh, our Novgorodian friends.
Off in the wonderful land of Novgorod, the boys there were unhappy with their current ruler. Surprise.
As always.
And this is because they tend to decide that the actual strongest ruler should preside over them. With Andrei being the one to push Rostislav I's forces away from Kyiv, the Novgorodians kicked out Grand Prince Rostislav I's son from the Novgorodian throne and asked Andrei to send one of his sons to rule over them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Andrei knew better than to trust the Novgorodians farther than he could throw them, and instead sent his brother, also called Rostislav.
Why not? They only got four names.
Right? The Novgorodians flat out refused to have Andrei's brother rule, so Andrei sent his nephew instead, who was Rostislav's son, who's called Mstislav the Eyeless.
Well, it's a good thing we've got an epithet there. Otherwise, it would just be another Mstislav.
See, we are going to cover this in a bit more detail in about two more episodes. Because Mstislav the Eyeless shows up in a bit more detail. With the Novgorodian issues now resolved, Andrei got a bit of great news from Vladimir. The foundations for his Kremlin were now done. So this is when he moved the capital from Suzdal over to Vladimir so he could get away from the court politics that were holding him down in those cities. And this is around the time that the issue surrounding Bishop Leo would arise in 1160. After the Bishop Leo controversy, Andrei would be told by some members of his household that his younger brothers were attempting to take control of his domains in secret. Due to this rumor, Andrei would remove several of his brothers and top advisors from the Suzdal lands, and he'd fully seize their territory, becoming the sole ruler of Suzdal. This led for his brother Mikhalkul and several of the Big Nest, more info on those two in the next over the next few episodes, to be exiled alongside their mother off to the Byzantine Empire, and Andrei would now be the sole ruler of Rostov, Suzdal, and Vladimir, and this was his main goal. Especially because his brothers were too young to rule on their own.
Mm-hmm.
Also, he disliked Mikhalkul's and Siavolod's mother because that's his stepmom.
Always got a hit on the stepmom.
Yeah. His father's former advisors would also be sent to the dungeons for attempting to dissuade him from taking his brother's territory.
To the dungeon with you for disagreeing with me.
Yep. With the Vladimir Suzdal lands now under his control, Andrei had to take a further step to consolidate his power. He had to attack the Cumans.
Why not?
They're his people, but this is a different tribe he has to attack.
Well, yeah, because the Cumans we use as a catch-all, but not all the Cumans are all allied to each other. They're not like a monolith.
Exactly. They're just different tribes kind of doing their own thing. But Andrei was kind of starting to feel his age a bit, and he wouldn't go on campaign himself. So he'd send his son, Izyaslav, alongside all of his allies to march deep into the steppe to fight the Cumans. The Vladimir forces made contact with their enemy, and a brutal display of fighting occurred between the two groups. The Cumans soon began to retreat. Aurora, what would you do if you're fighting the Cumans and they retreat?
Not chase after them with wild abandon, because you're likely to be lured past your supply lines to get surrounded and destroyed.
Well, the Vladimir army did not have you as their commander. And seeing their victory so close at hand, they pursued the Cumans deeper into the steppe.
Stretching their supply lines, outrunning the Sams, losing organization to a people that are more used to being on the open steppe. Yeah, I'm sure this goes really well.
So the Cumans then turned back around on their horses and charged right at the advancing Rus army. The Cumans crashed into the Vladimir ranks and devastated their forces. Though reduced in number, the Vladimir forces were not discouraged, and they continued their advance against the Cumans and pressed a counterattack. The Cumans were now confused, and this actually caused them to fully flee back into the steppe and straight into their camps.
Huh.
With a victory in hand, Izyaslav Andreevich, who was, you know, Andrei's son, returned home with a destroyed army. He may have won the day, but at what cost? Not long after this battle, Andrei was dealing with the issues of establishing his own metropolitan see, and the Patriarch of Constantinople denying Teddy as his choice, all of which you've already covered.
Mm-hmm.
So, to take his mind off this, Andrei actually joined his son Izyaslav on campaign against the Volga Bulgarians. So, we beat at the Cumans, let's fight the Bulgarians.
Yeah.
This campaign went so well, in fact, that they managed to take out a few of the tribes entirely, and one of the Bulgar princes barely managed to escape from the battlefield. During this battle, there were holy signs that pointed to Andrei's victory, and its anniversary marks the honey feast of the Savior holiday that is celebrated in Russia on August 14th. Not much details given about its establishment as a holiday, but we can talk about this holiday on Patreon soon. There's also poppy rolls too. Delicious, delicious poppy rolls.
Interesting.
Yeah, I love poppy rolls. Actually, as I wrote this, I ended up going with my partner to the Russian store to get poppy rolls and just eat a bunch of them. Despite the deliciousness of the poppy rolls and of the victory of the Volga Bulgarians, Andrei would receive the worst news ever.
His wife had died. His son had died.
His son, Izyaslav, had passed away.
Yeah. I knew it's ancient, this old Russia, it's not going to be that his wife died. The sad news is that your son and heir died.
Andrei buried his son Vladimir and wept throughout the whole service. This was his closest friend and advisor, and also his heir. And now he lay buried within a church in Vladimir. How could he ever get over this?
Going to war with somebody. Building a new church.
Well, we actually don't hear from Andrei for a few years. But we're going to have a bit of a tangent.
Oh boy. Andronikos tangent.
Down south in Galicia, we have the arrival of Andronikos Komnenos, nephew of the Byzantine Emperor Manuel, and future Byzantine Emperor himself.
Oh, we have a future emperor in the building.
Oh, yes. He doesn't meet Andrei, but he's a fun guy. Andronikos had managed to escape from prison down in Byzantium. Why was Andronikos imprisoned in Byzantium?
Plotting a coup.
You know, you're actually right.
It's Byzantium. What else would they be doing?
Very true. It was because Andronikos had attempted to usurp the throne from Emperor Manuel, and he also had an affair with Eudokia, who was Manuel's niece and his cousin, who was also 15 to his, like, 30.
Uh-huh.
That hasn't stopped anybody in power, has it?
Nah, not really.
Looking at you, Trump. Andronikos had already escaped once before from prison, and this time he was able to escape again because he feigned being ill and was given a boy to nurse after him. Using his charm and wit, he beguiled the boy to make wax impressions of the keys to his cell and get them delivered to Andronikos' son, who then made copies of the key. Andronikos was then able to walk out of prison unimpeded, and after spending 3 days hiding in the tall grass, he got onto a fishing boat. The fishermen agreed to help Andronikos, but on their way out, they were caught by two guards. Andronikos managed to convince them that he was an escaped slave and was let go.
Oh, sure.
This is when he finally made it to Galicia. Unfortunately, he would be captured by the Wallachians in modern-day Romania, who were going to bring him back to Emperor Manuel.
Mm-hmm.
During his time with the Wallachians, Andronikos would feign suffering from gastroenteritis, or infectious diarrhea, and would need to get off his horse to defecate alone and at a distance.
Oh, the faking being sick is always a good move.
After establishing a routine over a few days and letting his guards get complacent, Andronikos made a dummy out of his cloak, hat, and staff in the position of a man defecating.
Oh, hell yeah.
While the dummy was being watched going number two, Andronikos escaped and made his way to Galicia to the court of Yaroslav Eightwits.
He's like, yo, that's a classic. I'm going to set up a dummy of me pooping so I can escape.
There, Andronikos would attempt to hire the Cumans to aid him in invading the Byzantine Empire, but he would ultimately reconcile with Manuel and form an anti-Hungarian alliance with Yaroslav Eightwits and return home.
Hey, you know, sometimes all you need to do is agree to hate the Hungarians.
Yeah. Now, this tangent was completely unnecessary, but Andronikos showed up in the Russian Chronicles, and he's a fun guy. So if you want to hear more, listen to Totalis Rankium's episode on him.
Hey, look, I'm telling you, faking being sick to escape captivity is an all-time classic move.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
For a modern example, for someone people may have heard of, crazy billionaire tech guy John McAfee, two separate times faked having a heart attack to escape from jail.
Oh, man. Didn't he get killed or something?
He died eventually, yes. Yes, he did eventually die. But twice he got arrested, faked having a heart attack, and used it as a way to escape from jail. So
Yeah. He was a nutcase.
Just saying, it's a proven strategy.
It is.
Actual reign continued.
After the death of Andrei's son, Izislav, our prince falls off the map for a few years. So we can assume that things are peaceful. That is, until Mstislav II, Izyaslav's the second son, becomes the Grand Prince of Kiev. And Mstislav II is our last Grand Prince of Kiev that we're covering.
That's right, I remember him.
So what city have we not talked about for a hot second?
Novgorod!
Up north! The Novgorodians are up to mischief again, after having been quiet over the last few years. The Novgorodian boyars moved to arrest their current prince, but luckily, the prince managed to escape from the city before he could be taken to the dungeons or killed. Andrei wanted peace in the land, so he sent troops to aid the now former Prince of Novgorod, the son of former Kievan Grand Prince Rostislav I, Sviatoslav Rostislavich, and in doing so, decided to teach the Novgorodians a lesson. So, he burned the city of Novi Torg. The citizens of Novi Torg barely managed to escape to Novgorod as their life went up in flames. In the meantime, Andrei ordered his troops to devastate the Novgorodian districts and towns in the area. Andrei was so incensed with how the Novgorodians were acting that he would enter into an alliance with Smolensk and Polotsk against the Novgorodians, and in doing so, the three princes were able to cut off all the roads that led to Novgorod. They captured any envoys or merchants that were making their way out of Novgorod to Mstislav II with cause for aid. Rostislav I's son, Sviatoslav, attempted to get the Novgorodians to make him prince again, but the Novgorodians were too upset with him and refused. They were so upset, actually, that they killed the posadnik, or mayor, that was aiding him in accruing support for the position. After a while, the Novgorodians were finally able to get someone through Andrei's blockade, and a message arrived to Kiev asking Mstislav II to make his son the Prince of Novgorod. You can get more on that in Mstislav II's episode. The following year, Mstislav II had made a huge blunder. Well, he had gathered a bunch of allies and had gone on a campaign against the Cumans.
Oh, is this when he stole their money?
This is when he stole their money. So you did remember.
Yeah. It's because they went to war and then he just took all their money without paying them. So they fought and then he's like, yeah, you won't get paid.
This essentially led the Rus princes to hate him for his greed. With that action done, the Rus princes were looking for someone to help them put Mstislav II in his place. Enter our boy Andre. See, Mstislav II was still attempting to put his son as the Prince of Novgorod, all the while Andre was busy blockading the princedom. This was an affront to Andre, who saw Mstislav II's actions as an attempt to enter his northern sphere of influence. Mstislav II was successful in placing his son, Roman the Great. Andre became upset that his blockade failed due to Polotsk and Smolensk being worn down by the fighting, so he put out feelers to see if the Rus princes would be willing to help him take Mstislav II down a peg. They were willing, and Andre formed a coalition army against Mstislav II with one directive: take down Mstislav. After a few months, Andre brought together his allies and marched against Mstislav II. Well, Andre wouldn't do it himself. It was actually his son, Mstislav, also, who led the charge. And in this army, there were princes that Mstislav II had wronged or disillusioned, and Andre would have his brother Gleb assist, and he even brought back his brother Vsyevolod from Byzantium to assist as well. Of course, it wasn't just Rus princes that were in Andre's army. You had the Cumans, the Hungarians, the Czechs, the Poles, and Lithuanians. And he couldn't even be bothered to run this army because, as we mentioned earlier, he was starting to feel his age, so his son, also named Mstislav, took charge. Now, I could go into detail about the sack of Kiev again, but we did that in Mstislav II's episode, when, you know, we finished the Grand Princes of Kiev.
Yeah, and a bad time was had by everyone.
Yeah, not for Andre.
Well, yeah, for everyone that's not Andre.
Kiev was sacked, and Mstislav II was kicked out of the city and the throne. The city had many of its inhabitants slain, and was plundered by the coalition forces. Andre had every right to take the city for himself, but instead, he placed his brother Gleb in charge of Kiev. By doing so, Andre essentially placed the princedom of Vladimir Suzdal above that of Kiev, and he now held ultimate control of Rus. Now, here's a thing to note. Kiev will remain in a first among equals position, but that's going to be a name only.
Mm-hmm.
It's like that scene in Avengers Endgame where Star-Lord says, "Just so you know, this is my ship. I'm still in charge." And Thor goes, "I know." It gives him a look that just says, yeah, no.
Yeah, sure, bud.
Anyway, despite Andre's victory over Kiev in 1169, the Cumans then took the opportunity to rampage through Rus after the sack was done, especially with the Rus forces now being depleted due to all the internecine warfare that was going around. It's around this time that Andre was dealing with Teddy's mess, and he had Teddy punished and shipped off to Kiev in 1170.
All right.
Okay, so the same nuisance city that we have, Novgorod,
uh-huh.
Again,
as they like to do.
So they banded together to beat the Chud tribe.
Mm-hmm.
They marched to Bilo-Ozera, which is modern-day Bilozersk, which is northeast of St. Petersburg. And on the way there, they encountered a combined force from Suzdal and Ryazan that numbered 7,300 men that had been sent by Andre to punish the Novgorodians. This Novgorodian contingent was only 500 people total.
Okay.
Through some sort of miracle, the Novgorodian force managed to beat the Suzdalian force, killing 1,300 of them, while only losing 15 men.
Good lord.
Obviously, this angered Andre, and he assembled another large host, and he sent his son Mstislav to head this army as well. The new Vladimirian army marched against Novgorod, and they managed to capture and burn down many towns, slay the men, enslave the women, children, and carry off lots of plunder. When Mstislav's force finally arrived at Novgorod, the Kremlin fortifications there were quite strong, leading Mstislav to order them to assault the walls. 3 days of intense fighting occurred, and Novgorod sent out envoys to broker a peace deal, but Mstislav and the Novgorodians could not come to an agreement. Inside Novgorod, there was an archbishop known as Ivan the Miracle Maker, or Ivan Chudotvorets.
Mm-hmm.
He prayed day and night for the salvation of the city, and one day he heard a voice telling him to take the icon of the Holy Theotokos and place her opposite of the Suzdalian army. So we're getting a bit of reverse here.
Mm-hmm.
Archbishop Ivan managed to convince the Novgorodian boyars to do so, and together they prayed for the Theotokos to intercede on their behalf. It was at that moment that Andrei's army shot volley after volley into Novgorod, and the city was forced to split into two camps, one leading to surrender and the other to keep fighting.
Sure.
Then the icon turned towards the city gates on her own and shed tears. Archbishop Ivan witnessed this miracle, and then the sky darkened, Ash filled the air around the Suzdalian army, blinding them and filling them with terror and confusion. The Novgorodians were unaffected and used this to their advantage, and sallied forth to attack their besiegers. They managed to capture some, and the remaining Suzdalians that were alive escaped by the skin of their teeth. On the way back to Suzdal, the remains of the army were set upon by all the citizens of the towns that they had captured and burned, and these Novgorodian citizens were able to retake their family and possessions. This loss really injured Andrei's prestige as a sacker of Kiev, and would show that he was unable to actually have a victorious army.
Oof, Mr. Pius here not having the divine intervention on his side this time.
No. Back in Kiev, Prince Gleb had managed to make a peace agreement with the Cumans. Gleb used his chance to go and meet with them, but other Cuman tribes used the time it would take for him to travel there to raid around Rus.
Oh, it's time for a little bit of raiding.
Yeah. Well, this raiding band of Cumans arrived at the Church of the Transfiguration of the Lord and saw an icon of the Theotokos. The icon spewed forth fiery flames which burned many of the Cumans right where they stood. Those who remained fled from the scenes, heavily burned. Gleb, upon hearing the news, wanted to fight against these Cumans, but the Berendei tribe that he worked with told him to not do so without a large army. Instead, Gleb sent his brother Mikhalko, future Grand Prince of Vladimir, to fight some of these groups. Mikhalko came upon a group of sleeping Cumans and managed to slay some and capture others, who then relayed the story of how their massive host of 17,000 men were reduced to 300 people due to an icon.
Oof.
This news led the Cumans to send an additional 10,000 Cumans to attack Rus. Mikhalko sped off with his Druzhina to fight the large Cuman force, but before they could all come together and prepare for the upcoming battle, the Cumans took him by surprise and were prepared to slaughter him where he stood. However, as they saw Mikhalko, they dropped their weapons, armor, and shields, and sped off naked on their horses.
That seems a bit excessive, but sure.
It also doesn't make sense to me how they could take their armor off so easily, since unless they're like lightly armored, but even then it's like a lot of like ribbons to untie and like drop.
And you're just on horseback stripping?
Yeah, basically. I actually had this script edited slightly by Dustin from the Alexander Standard, and he added a fun comment, which I'm going to keep in here. Oh my gosh, it's a Mikhalko. What do we do? Quick, everybody get naked. What? Why? Everyone knows that Mikhalko has only one weakness. That's right, nudity. He can't see us if we're naked. Take it off, everybody. Yes, Carl. You too. Yes, all of it, Carl. Yeah, Carl. Don't fuck this up for us. Take your pants off. The Cumans did not get very far as their horses fell dead on the ground, crushing their riders beneath them.
Yeah, that's because Cuman Carl didn't take his pants off.
Cuman Carl, that's just our Cuman name now.
Yeah.
Thank you, Dustin. You made Cuman Carl happen. With that, through intercession of the Theotokos, the Cumans were beaten back. Unfortunately, despite this major success for the Rus, Gleb would end up passing away. Andrei would send Roman Rostislavich of Smolensk to be the Prince of Kiev, while Roman's son took his father's place in Smolensk. Andrei would then send his son, Mstislav, on a campaign against the Volga Bulgarians. However, Andrei made a huge mistake. Can you guess what that is?
No.
What's the number one robot fighting in Russia?
Not to do it in the winter.
Can you guess when Andrei sent his son on campaign?
In the winter.
Oh, yeah. Which made the campaign rather strenuous.
I bet it did.
Because of the weather? Not all who wanted to fight could make it to him so quickly, so Mstislav had to wait for his allies to arrive with the baggage train. But Mstislav was a busy bee and managed to capture 6 towns and 7 cities, and some women and children while slaying the men. The Volga Bulgars did not take kindly to this and sent 7,000 men against Mstislav, but Mstislav managed to evade them. However, the weather took its toll on the men and supplies were dwindling. Mstislav himself had developed quite a serious cough and made a decision to return home to Vladimir to recover. Around this time, Andrei would place his own brother Mikhalko as the Prince of Kiev. Once Mstislav returned home, his health turned for the worse and he died of his illness and was buried in Vladimir.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's another son dead.
He's not doing too good.
Not at all. So Aurora, who haven't we heard from in a few minutes again?
Novgorodians.
Well, they revolted again and kicked out their prince again.
Sounds about right.
Yeah. This time they asked Andrei to send his son to rule Novgorod. And Andrei is like, fine. I'll send my son, Yuri Bogolyubsky, who would be the one who goes off to marry Queen Tamar the Great of Georgia.
That's right.
But not married yet. This is like in 30 years time. Or like 10 years time, actually. Andrei would then send an ambassador to Kiev and demand that the Rostislavichi that he had placed on the throne leave the city and return it to Andrei's family. Well, the Smolensk princes, who were in charge of Kiev now, thanks to Andrei, took offense to this, and one of them, Mstislav the Brave, who was a prince of Vyshgorod, shaved the head and beard of Andrei's envoy and sent it back to our prince. See, the shaving of the head and beard is actually a huge sign of disrespect, and the forcible tonsure of someone, which also violated the Ruskaya Pravda or the Russian law. Well, just the beard shaving.
Okay, yeah.
So if you cut, like, you know, someone shaved my beard, I could sue them, essentially.
You know what? Fair.
To further insult Andrei, the Prince of Vyshgorod, Mstislav the Brave, would arrest Andrei's brother Vsyevolod the Big Nest. Andrei would then attack Vyshgorod, placing his son Yuri in charge of his army while he stayed back in Vladimir.
Wait, side note, did you promise to explain to me later what Big Nest means?
Yes, I will explain that in his episode, because you'll see why.
All right. Battle of Vyshgorod.
The Prince of Vyshgorod, Mstislav the Brave, marched out into the river valley once he saw Andrei's army, and there archers from both sides met and began to shoot. Mstislav the Brave then abruptly pushed to attack Yuri's center and crushed it. But since the Prince of Vyshgorod had a small force, Yuri's troops were able to envelop Vyshgorod's men, but soon they became confused. They attacked each other, wounding each other, but not killing many. The Vyshgorodian troops then retreated into the city, and Yuri besieged the fortress. They attacked every day, and the Vyshgorodians sallied forth. There was much fighting, but this continued without making headway for about 9 weeks. Yuri then learned that the Prince of Lutsk and his Galician-Volhynian allies were on their way to reinforce Vyshgorod, and that the Prince of Lutsk had managed to negotiate with the Prince of Chernigov and cause him to defect over to Kiev's side. The next day, Yuri's army would be defeated in battle by the reinforcements, and they fled home. This would be another strike in Andrei's power, leading to further loss of influence. The Prince of Lutsk would end up becoming the new Prince of Kiev. Yuri's loss in Vyshgorod was also bad news for him as well, because the Novgorodians would remove him as the Prince of Novgorod and ask the Prince of Vyshgorod's nephew to take the throne instead. So, are things looking up Andrei currently?
No, they're going pretty poorly for Mr. Andy Pants over here.
Yeah, and with his intense loss of prestige, he had faced two major campaign losses, one in Novgorod in 1171, and just the one we just covered in Kiev in 1174. Then, in June 1174, we had a group of boyars coming together to meet. One of these boyars stated that Andrei had ordered his brother to be executed for a crime, and the boyar ran over to Pyotr Kuchkov, who was Andrei's brother-in-law. Kuchkov riled up the boyars, shouting that if Andrei could get away with killing one boyar, he'd kill them all if he could.
Mm-hmm.
Now, don't forget that the Kuchkovs still have a blood debt with Andrei's family for the execution of Stepan Kuchkov, Andrei's father-in-law.
Yeah, they still have that thing going on from, you know, the guy that tried to assassinate Yuri.
Yeah. So these boyars came together and took up their weapons and snuck into the Andrei's palace in the cover of the night and would be let in by Ulita, Andrei's wife, since she was Pyotr's sister.
Oh, the snail betrayed him.
Yep.
After all these years?
After all these years.
Ugh, rude. They're gonna kill righteous Andy.
Most of the boyars present were from the Kuchkov family. As they swept through the palace, looking for Andrei's room, the Kuchkovs would murder the palace guards and the servants that Andrei had.
Wait, so his wife let them in, but didn't tell them where his room was?
Yeah.
Okay.
They would pass by the room of Ulita, Andrei's wife. She'd look over at her brother Pyotr, walk into her room, and close the door. The Kuchkovs were then forced away into Andrei's bedroom, and in the cover of the night, Pyotr would yell out, my lord, grand prince. Andrei would ask, who are you? With Pyotr responding, I'm Prokopy. Prokopy being one of Andrei's servants. Andrei was confused as he knew that was not his servant's voice. So he said, no, you're not Prokopy.
Uh-huh.
But it was too late for the Grand Prince, because by responding, he had confirmed his presence in the room. On hearing his voice, the assassins rush into the room, blades drawn, and with immense thirst for the prince's blood. Andrei leapt towards his sword, but one of his assassins was his key holder and had taken a sword from his room ahead of time. Two of these assassins moved to grab Andrei, but Andrei managed to pull away from one of them and essentially judo flip one of them onto the ground.
All right, fighting back at least.
Seeing a shadow on the floor, the assassins began stabbing at the fallen man, killing him. Once they noticed it was not Andrei, they found him once more and struck him with their swords. Andrei would yell, woe to you, accursed infidels! Why do you follow the example of Boris and Gleb's murderers? what manner of harm have I caused you that you wish to shed my blood on the earth? God will take revenge upon you, for you have eaten my bread.
That's a really long-winded thing to say while you're being stabbed. I'm not going to lie.
I know. Blame the chroniclers.
Yeah, because I feel like he'd be more saying things like, fuck you.
God damn it.
What are you doing? Ouch. Ow. Damn it. Stop it. You losers.
Oh, stop it, you losers.
Not like you have eaten my bread. May God be accursed upon your soul or something.
Andre fell to the ground, but was hidden under the darkness. The assassins then dragged the body out, but once they were in the moonlight, they saw it was a dead boy or they had killed.
They got the wrong body again?
Yeah. Andre, in the meantime, had used the confusion to run out of the room, but he had been stabbed a few times and had left the blood trail behind him as he finally went to hide beneath the porch of his palace. He hid himself as best as he could against one of the foundation pillars. Andre held his breath and thought of several prayers that he could mutter quickly to the Theotokos, hoping that he could survive the night. However, one of Andre's servants had noticed a blood trail that it had led to a hidden location underneath the porch and told Andre's assassins.
Wow, really loyal servants there. You got Mr. Righteous Andy.
Yeah. I mean, it's either he dies or Andre dies. So
yeah, fair. Okay. I also don't think you should die for a noble, so whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Piotr, you know, Andre's brother-in-law, decided, hey, maybe we should bring out a torch.
Finally.
And they lit up the torch, and they could see the blood trail leading to the pillar beneath the porch. Andre stood up to defend himself, bringing out his arm to block the blow. But the assailants cut the prince's right arm off and then pierced them with a sword. Andre looked at his assailants as they withdrew the sword, blood gurgling from his mouth and pooling all around him. And he collapsed to the floor, dead.
Rest in peace.
The next morning, Andre's body was found half hidden under the porch. The clergy of Bogolyubova, a town named after him, as we said, took his body and carried it into the church and laid it into a stone sarcophagus. The burghers of Bogolyubova and his servants would then sack his house and take all his possessions and wealth, as well as anything else that he might have owned around the area.
You know, it is really funny to me, particularly after watching that Yuri Dolgoruki movie.
Yeah.
You know, that despite how that movie goes and the change of heart and everything, that after all that time, Ulita still betrays him at the end.
Well, what I got from it is that she was just going to be in peace, but you could tell that she's going to do something at the end.
Well,
eventually.
Kind of, I guess. But it's like she gives up on those assassination plans. And like she tells Andre about the plan to assassinate Yuri because she like feels bad or whatever.
Yeah. Well, that's why it's a movie and it's not accurate, but
yeah, because instead Ulita held that grudge forever.
Yep. Well, Aurora, do you want to know what happened with the conspirators?
I bet a bunch of them also got killed.
Well, one of Andre's successors, spoiler, it's his brother Vsyevolod the Big Nest, actually ended up catching all of his brother's assassins, placed them in baskets, and drowned them in the lake.
Yep.
Andre's wife, Ulita, would then be found guilty of the murder as well and would be executed for her participation.
Yeah, well, you know, it is correct. She was guilty of that shit. Mm-hmm. My girl did do all that.
She did. So, one last thing. Andre has a long, long life, and we'll get to it when we actually get into the rounds. But Andre would finally be canonized as a saint in 1702, with his relics being in St. Andrew's Chapel of the Assumption Cathedral in Vladimir. His relics would finally be taken by the Soviets and placed in a state historical museum in Vladimir, and his body would later be taken to be examined. They determined that while he did have a large number of injuries on his body, as well as a severed arm, he didn't die from actually being struck in a vital organ, but from severe bleeding.
Yeah, he bled out because his assassins were bad at stabbing.
Yeah, he had a total of 16 injuries and a cut arm. So that's how we can attest that this story is actually real.
Yeah, that his body was missing an arm. That's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Also, from a number of famous assassinations throughout history, it has come to my attention that it seems to be actually kind of hard to stab someone to death. Because a lot of assassinations in history seem to take a lot of people stabbing, like, way more than you would think.
Yeah. So it's like people just don't die immediately from being stabbed once.
Yeah. You know what? Something tells me the movies haven't been telling me the truth.
Yeah. Well, are you ready to rank them?
I am. Let's go.
Hello and bonjour. My name is Josh Zucker, and I want to take you on a journey through some of the most exciting events of the late Middle Ages. Valois Burgundy was one of the medieval world's greatest what-ifs. Its dukes inherited, conquered, and politicked their way into forging a state between the German Empire and the Kingdom of France that rivaled them both. From the Hundred Years' War to the Holy Roman Empire, from urban workers to Joan of Arc, and from gallant knights to gunpowder weapons, the Grand Dukes of the West had a part to play in almost all of Western Europe's biggest developments in the 14th and 15th centuries. If you want to learn more about the glamorous rise and dramatic fall of the Dukes of Burgundy, please join me for Grand Dukes of the West, A History of Valois Burgundy.
Gamarjoba, my name is Roberto, and I would like to sincerely thank you for taking the time to check out my podcast, The History of Sakartvelo, Georgia. In all likelihood, I would venture to guess that you found us because you were searching for either podcasts, YouTube videos, blogs about the history of Georgia, or you're hearing this on another podcast, like this one. I'm both sorry and happy to report that this beautiful and fascinating country is, to my great surprise, criminally underrated in the history world. As of now, this is the only podcast I am aware of dedicated to the full history of a nation and a people that have served as the battleground for empires all throughout European and Asian history. But the land of the Kartveli is so much more than that. The birthplace of wine, the second Christian kingdom, the land of fantastic food, nearly superhuman dancers and musicians, and perhaps, most importantly, a people that have preserved their culture, pride, and independence after centuries of one conquest after another. Empires rise and fall, but Sakartvelo always seems to survive in the end. So, let us celebrate this beautiful land by coming with me on this journey from prehistory to the present day, right here at the History of Sakartvelo, Georgia. You can find us on Twitter at @history_Georgia. Sakartvelo is spelled Sakartvelo. Now back to your regularly scheduled podcast. Specialne operacija.
Special operations.
How well did they do in battle, lead in battle, or have others lead in battle for them?
Boo.
Well,
not very good, frankly.
Yeah. Let's just go through the list. So he aided his father and brothers in battle several times, but he mostly had to retreat a lot. Andre and his youth tended to fight in the front lines and would be injured quite frequently, but always managed to escape in the nick of time from death.
I mean, you do get, to me, you get slight points for fighting on the front line, okay? Mm-hmm. You get some points for that.
His attempts to sally forth did actually increase Suzanne's motivation against Chernigov, but the siege did fail because of Chernigov getting reinforcements.
Yeah.
However, a big mark on his name is he did have someone lead in battle for him and was able to get Kyiv sacked.
Yeah, his one big accomplishment was sacking Kyiv, but somebody else was leading for him at the time.
Well, and we get points for that.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we're going to have rulers later on who, like, in their palace while they have generals doing all the work for them.
Look, all I'm saying is it's going to annoy me in specific ways with certain leaders who have some of the greatest generals in history winning all their wars for them. Not to name any names. Stalin.
Yeah, Stalin.
Yeah.
Anyway. However, his attempts to conquer Novgorod and Vyshgorod brought him down.
Yeah, failed.
So that's pretty much it. Anything else that you can recall?
Aside from that one, he just doesn't really seem to do that well.
So, like, what are you thinking?
Three?
I'm thinking a two.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
He's just not that great at fighting.
I was giving a little weight to the fact that the one thing he did win was sort of, like, history-changing, and that, like, Kyiv was never that important, never as important, like, after that sack, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe I was adding a little too much weight to that, like sort of the historicity of the result of that battle that he won. Whereas like if you do it on the whole for battles, you're right. It's like a two.
So you want to change your score then? Or
I will change that one down to a two, yeah.
Okay. So that's a four for special operations. Uspiech.
Oh crap, I forgot the order we do these in.
Success. How successful were they in running their nation? What cultural significance did they leave behind? Okay. This may end up being his round.
Just because of the churches and like the icons and stuff.
Yeah. So first off to start, he destroyed Kyiv's power to bolster his own and move the power center over to Vladimir. Even if it's not consolidated in Vladimir just yet, it will be. At least by his brother's reign.
Yeah.
So there's that big thing. He was also canonized as a saint, so like he's going to be famous forever now.
Mm-hmm.
He also built up several churches that are still standing today, and they're known as the White Monuments of Vladimir and Suzdal.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Basically, anything from 1150 to 1172.
Those do look really cool. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah, and they're still lasting today. And Vladimir is actually known to be one of the most beautiful cities in Russia. And it's because of this.
One of the most picturesque, like, yeah, I can see that.
Yeah, so lots of stuff there. Bogolyubova, his palace, is still around today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, his victory started a holiday called Honey Feast of the Savior, where you eat poppy rolls.
Yeah, I feel like culturally we're going to have to kind of go all out.
Oh, I'm not done yet. He would also write a number of literary works glorifying the Theotokos, as well as the victories that he did have. He would also get the church in Vladimir Suzdal to begin systematic chronicling, starting the Suzdalian Chronicle.
He also got Vladimir turned into its own, like, seat, right?
Holy See, but, like, it's a powerful...
Yeah, Holy See, yeah.
But it's still, like, more powerful than it was before because of him. However, on a downside, none of his sons actually end up succeeding him.
Yeah, but is that his fault?
No.
If, like, they died, in one of those wars that he lost, and it was, like, his fault that they died, like, I would put that on his shoulders. But if, like, dude just, like, gets sick, you know, canonically dies of dysentery or whatever it is we decide every soldier on campaign dies of, then you could say, like, well, how stable was the kingdom when it went to whoever his successor was, which happens to be his brother?
I mean, he was assassinated, so not that stable.
Yeah. To be fair, that was like a sort of like a blood feud he inherited from his dad.
Yeah. And it was like, oh, I married your sister-in-law. And it's like, oh, we're going to kill you guys, but we're going to talk about that as death. So
yeah.
What are you thinking?
So for like cultural impact, oof, 9?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah. 9.
Mostly because, like, if it was, like, a stable succession, it'd be fine, but there's going to be some fighting afterwards, and he was assassinated, which brings it down, because saber rulers aren't assassinated.
If he had passed it on to, even if not to his sons, like, if he had passed it on to his brother, you know, because he died naturally or from sickness or whatever, and it was, like, a peaceful transfer of power because his kingdom was stable, then it would be even better. But yeah, I'll give him a 9 still.
Yeah, so I'll give him a 9, same thing, like, I know the names that are coming up, and Andrei is one of those names that are like, this is a big name, and especially because he's the first prince of Vladimir Suzdal. The main thing is he's set power to go from Kiev to here.
Yeah.
And started that change, which would end up leading to Muscovy. Basically, he's setting the events in motion that his brother will then solidify in his episode.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
All right, so that's an 18 for Uspiech.
That's probably going to save a lot of his total score, I think.
Yeah. Kompromat.
Blackmail.
What things did he do behind closed doors or outwardly do that made others dislike them? The first thing is that he stole an icon from his father.
He did steal an icon from his father, but that ended up being up one of the most famous in things he did that people like revered him for, was saving that icon in a way.
Okay, so like, here's the thing. I went with the view that the Kievan Chronicle gave it, who was upset that he stole the icon.
Correct. But because we did that, we have the chronicle, or we have the icon still.
Yes. The Suzdalian Chronicle states that his father gave it to him. Now, this is a he said, she said. But also, who ordered the Suzdalian Chronicle to be written?
Well, Mr. Andy, of course.
Yeah, so of course he's going to say, I didn't steal it. My dad gave it to me.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Much like the Chronicle saying that he gave this speech about holiness to his father, and his dad totally listened to him.
Exactly. Now, he did sack Kiev, which we give him credit for in his prout, is like fighting.
Yeah.
But just the craziness of it all, how they essentially slaughtered a whole mass of the populace.
Yeah, it's real bad.
I know it's war, but I also think like it was really bad. Kiev would not recover.
No.
And there's a certain group of people who would make sure that they never recover for a long time. Coming up soon.
We're going to talk about those people soon, huh?
Yeah.
It's sort of a... Do we call it a huge cloud on the horizon? An approaching storm.
Yeah. Basically, Kiev's fucked. This is how it is.
Yeah. I think because of what we know is coming, it would have been fucked anyway. He just sort of did it first.
Exactly.
Still bad, though.
Yeah. He then ousted his brothers to take sole control of Suzdal. To become the sole ruler of the area. Which, granted, cool thing, but... He kicked his brothers to Byzantium. Like, come on, dude. They were still kids.
Oh, no. We have to go to a place that's way more rich and way more cultured.
Oh, no. They have good food.
No, they've got good food, better architecture. No. Sorry, Russia fans. I'm sorry. Let's be real here.
I love Greek food more. I like Russian food. So,
and let's be real. At the time, that was the center of culture.
Yeah, for real. So another thing is he would believe some of the heretical items that his bishops were espousing because, you know, he put them in place.
Yeah, despite being Mr. Pious.
And he was quite a cruel person. People wouldn't assassinate him or like say, oh, they're going to kill us just for no reason. And he also placed Teddy as bishop because he liked him as a guy, not for his religion. Uh-huh. And Teddy was super fucking cruel.
Yeah, Teddy was awful.
Like, you can't keep someone in power for that long knowing that they do these things and then only getting mad at them once they blaspheme.
Yeah, like, so even though it's not like his compromise, it's like the fact that he tolerated that sort of thing.
Yeah, and it wasn't like it wasn't an open secret. Like, he was doing this to everybody.
If I make another sort of future allusion, having a sort of head of a very important person in your government who's routinely doing lots of horrible things and everyone knowing it and you just never doing anything about it sort of reflects poorly on you, Stalin.
Aurora, would you like a white flower? By the way, we are going to cover Barry because we have to.
Oh, God, this is going to be the worst episodes of my life. We're talking about, Laurenti Beria.
Yeah, sorry. I don't think I have to research it.
Oh, God.
But we're doing the Successors of Stalin series, so.
That specific thing, to like, yeah, I've got this advisor who's the worst person imaginable. And I know about it and everyone knows about it. Not doing something about it reflects really poorly on you.
Exactly. So what are you thinking about for Compromat?
Still, even though it's bad, I still want to put him vaguely middle of the road. Because he's like a bad person, but he's not like an actively like sort of cloak and dagger manipulative kind.
Yeah,
you know?
He just has shit people around him.
I'll call it like a five.
That's what I was thinking as well. Because like, it's not that he's a shit person. He just has shit people around him that he tolerates, which makes him a shit person.
Yeah, like, let's be real. He's not his dad.
No. Yuri got a bit higher. He got a 6 and an 8.
Yeah, I think, and I think Andre should be below Yuri.
So that's a 10 for Compromat. Next up, we have Boje Moi.
Oh my God.
Okay, so we actually have a few descriptions about Andre, even just how he is as a person. Andre loved to forget himself in the heat of battle, to rush into the most dangerous melee, and did not notice how his helmet was knocked off. All this was very common in the South, where constant external dangers and civil strife developed the daring of princes. But Andre's ability to quickly sober up from warlike intoxication was not at all common. Immediately after a heated battle, he became a cautious, prudent politician, a prudent manager. Andre always had everything in order and ready. He could not be taken by surprise. He knew how to not lose his head in the midst of general confusion.
Except for that time he got stabbed in his own house.
Yeah. In his habit of being on guard every minute and bringing order everywhere, he resembled his grandfather Vladimir Monomakh. Despite his martial prowess, Andre did not like war, and after a successful battle, he was the first to approach his father with a request to make peace with the defeated enemy. He's more of a manager than his dad was.
Yeah.
This is a description by Vasily Kluchevsky, who's a historian.
Okay, I'm ready.
So this time, I'm not going to send you a painting.
Oh.
I'm going to send you something a lot more interesting. Because you remember how I mentioned that his relics were taken by the Soviets?
Oh, so do we have like a...
We have a facial reconstruction.
Like a facial reconstruction? Do we have like an icon? We got some...
No, we have an actual bus facial reconstruction.
All right, let's see it.
So the skull was taken to be reconstructed, where he is noted to have a blend of North Slavic features, as well as Cuban features due to his mother.
I was going to say, he should look vaguely Cuban, because his mom was a Cuban princess, right?
Yes.
All right, Andre.
So... We're gonna base him off this picture, but I'm going to send you like an icon from here. Can you talk about that picture first?
Okay, so here we have like this sort of bronze bust, like reconstruction of him. And they definitely sort of leaned into like the sort of more Cuban aspect of him, like around like the eyes, you know, I think. Mm-hmm. But he's got sort of like medium-ish length, like swept back hair, a solid beard. Some sick arched eyebrows. I'm going to give him that. He looks very like he's trying to look imposing or look like regal in a way. You know, wearing like a nice coat. It looks pretty nice. Not going to lie. Ooh, so off this bust. Oof.
It's like to be our first Asian.
Let's, you know what? I honestly, I'm going to grade him pretty high on this one, I think. Like, I think I might give him like an 8, maybe.
I was thinking a 9 for me.
Yeah, right in the same ballpark.
Yeah, same ballpark. That gives him what? 17.
Yeah. Yeah, he looks pretty smooth. You know, like he looks smooth.
I like this. I saw this guy and I was like, oh shit, we have a facial reconstruction. Aurora's gonna love this.
Yeah, well, I mean, you heard my noise as I opened up. I was like, ooh, look at this.
Yeah. So, all right, that gives us a 17 for Bojo Moy. But we're not done yet because I'm gonna send you a few more pictures. So one of them is an icon. That's just like the main portrait that tends to get used.
Yeah, the icon definitely is more
like European.
Yeah, European and like Slavic and Scandi than like the bust.
Yeah. Then there's a painting of him getting murdered.
Mm-hmm.
He's the one on the floor, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah, that which is pretty sick. I gotta say, leading with the bust was a good choice. Definitely rated him higher with that, like the bust reconstruction.
I mean, it's his actual face. Why would we not use that?
Yeah, no, that's good. That's good. I like him in that one. That's good.
So that is a 17, as I said. All right, Smiert.
Death.
How did they die?
Assassinated. That's pretty interesting. And it was full of twists and turns too. Like they had to sneak into his palace. And then they had to like sort of yell at him to figure out which room he was in. Then they stabbed the wrong guy. Then they grabbed the wrong body even after that. And he tried to hide under the porch. Like that's lots of twists and turns. And he got assassinated. Like, frankly, that story was entertaining to me. It required a lot of betrayal and all that other thing. I think I'm going to give that one, I'm giving that probably like a 9. Because I think unless you're getting ripped in half by trees, it's going to hard to be a 10. But I think like a 9 is pretty good.
So I am going to go for the full 10 because I read this and I was like, oh my God, we have a bust and we have a nice death to go along with it.
Yeah. This is good. This is a guy give us some real meat on the bones for this.
But you know what? I think a 19 is good. It's not a memorable death, but it's like it was a funny death.
Like the actual dying part isn't memorable, but like it's like the almost, if you can say it, like Benny Hill-esque hijinks leading up to it are worth it, you know?
Yeah, exactly. It's a fun death.
That assassination to me is like references like a bunch of like sort of the later Roman assassinations, you know, where like the Praetorian guards are running around the palace trying to find a guy who's hiding under a sheet or something. It's got that sort of energy to it.
Yeah, exactly. That gives him a 19, which is actually our best score since his dad.
Hell yeah.
So Andre is coming off strong here.
Yeah.
And finally, Vladislav, which is sovereignty.
Sovereignty. How long did they rule?
How long do you think he ruled for Aurora?
27 years, 30 years, something like that. Because I think he lived, even though he was assassinated, I feel like he was pretty old when he got assassinated.
Andrei Bogolyubsky ruled the throne of Vladimir Suzdal from June 4th, 1157, until his assassination on June 29th, 1174.
So it was like 20-something years?
Just a bit over 17 years, or a score of 6.77.
Pretty good.
So all of this brings him a final score of 66.27. We haven't had a score that high since Vladimir the Great.
Andre is our highest score since, with that Vladimir Monomakh?
Let me double check here. Yurdogoruki was a 57.
Yeah.
Vladimir Monomakh was a 55. I can't see anything below 66 other than Vladimir the Great at 75.
Oh, wow.
Oh boy, he's second place.
What, overall or just in a while?
Overall.
He got a higher score than like...
than Olga. He beat Olga.
Oh, wow.
Oh, okay, so in special operations, Olga has an 11. He has a 4. In,
an 11.
In success, right. Olga has a 20. Andre has an 18. So not winning so far. Compromat, Olga has an 18. Andre has a 10.
Well, the death ones definitely boosted him a lot.
Yeah, Bojan Moy, Olga has an 8.75. Andre has an 8.5. Smiert, Olga has a 0. He has a... Oh, you know what? I messed that up.
Did you not give Olga death points?
Nope, I didn't. I didn't divide it by 2.
Yeah, see, come on now.
Okay, 9.5. He beats Olga by 1 point in death, but this actually brings him to a total of 56.77 points, which puts him down in 7th place. So Olga keeps her spot.
Okay, yeah, I he's good, but he's not that good. I'm glad we took the time to verify that.
Thanks for correcting my math, y'all. Now, we just have one important question, Aurora.
Uh-huh.
Is Andre pious enough? Is he cruel enough? Is he deserving to go party down the Kremlin, or does he get shipped off to the gulag?
Oh, man. Here's the thing. Can we be honest with each other? Can I be honest with you right now as co-hosts?
Yeah.
Can we just have an aside? Let's be honest. Score-wise, I feel like, and through his impact on history, I feel like he has to go to the Kremlin. I don't want to. but I think he has to.
Can I be honest?
Yeah.
I'm not feeling it.
Yeah, see? Like, he, despite all this, despite his scores, despite his impact, despite everything he did, I don't want to send him. I don't want to.
You know what? We don't have to.
Get him out of here.
Get him out of here. Off to the gulag.
And honestly, listeners, I'm sorry. I have no explanation for you besides I just don't feel like he deserves it. He did like a lot of things, but at no point in it did I feel this sense of like, ooh, he's impressive from him, you know?
Yeah, like he did things, but he's never like, oh my gosh, this guy is somebody I want to talk about. I mean, I did want to talk about him. The only thing I'm going to tell you about him is like, oh yeah, he died in a very cool way.
Yeah, like the most interesting thing about him is that
he sacked Kiev.
He sacked,
which he didn't even leave the army for. It was his son.
Yeah, he was technically in charge of sacking Kiev, stole an icon, and was assassinated. And like to me, that's just not it. That's not enough to send you to the Kremlin. I'm sorry.
Oh, sorry, Andrei. Guess you're off to the gulag. Wow.
Go be pious somewhere else.
Well, even looking at like our new top ten, everyone else is in the Kremlin but him.
I was going to say, he's like the only one in the top 10 that's not in the Kremlin.
Yeah, but you know, as we go further along, this is going to start happening more and more.
Yeah.
We're going to have people like, oh, they lived cool lives, but you know, they just weren't that good enough, essentially.
Yeah, yeah, no. You know what? I'm glad we had the heart-to-heart. I'm glad we agree. Get out of here.
I thought you're cool, but there's cooler people coming up after you, and one of them is hanging up on my wall right now. So, you know, and he's not even your direct descendant. We'll have cooler people.
Exactly, exactly.
So it is now time for our recommendations.
I want to recommend the video game Dead Island 2. If you want a video game where you get to run around through some really gorgeous environments and really get into some really well-designed zombie slaying to a cool soundtrack, you should play Dead Island 2. Like, the game is visually very, very well done. The soundtrack's great. The levels are fun. And it is the most fun I've had in a really long time playing any sort of, like, zombie slayer game.
The Dead Island games are fucking fun, though. Like,
yeah. Dead Island 2, Escape from Hell-A. Fantastic game. I've been playing it co-op, and it is a ton of fun.
I love that. Well, it's funny that you recommend a game about zombies because I'm doing the same today. So I've been playing Graveyard Keeper.
Okay.
It's like Stardew Valley, mm-hmm. but zombies.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You have your farm component. You run a church. You have a little farm that you grow stuff on. And the premise is you get isekai'd because you get run over by a truck. And you wake up in this medieval world and you become a graveyard keeper. So yeah, we have two zombie themes today.
Two different styles of going about it. Both good. Both good.
Mm-hmm. So if you want to get more direct content with us, feel free to access our website at zarpower.com. There you can find the show notes, pictures, and bibliography, and vote on whether you think Andrei Bogolyubsky deserves a Kremlin or if he should actually be sent to the gulag.
It's honestly a drop, but I want to see if the listeners disagree with us on this one.
Yeah, you know, I said to actually update the website for once. It also has links to our social media, which is just typically ZarPowerPod. Zar is spelled T-S-A-R. Do not do any of that CZ BS. We're not Polish. So, Aurora, where can they find you?
You know what? Don't. Right here. Find me right here on the show. That's where you should find me. Don't find me on social media because it's a terrible place. The only social media I use is one that nobody should be using. So don't find me there.
Your other show?
Say, if you're interested in fantasy or science fiction, you can check out my other podcast, which is called Sword, Sorcery, and Socialism. Me and my co-host Ketho talk about fantasy and sci-fi books and sort of break down the sort of themes and the politics either the books intend for you to take or the ones that are sort of in the book with the author didn't intend. It's pretty fun. We've had Roberto on a couple times. It's good. If you like books and reading from one person who doesn't read and one person who has a degree in writing, you know.
You know, sadly, I probably won't be coming on the show that more often because you're on here with me all the time now. If you'd like to support the show and help us expand and grow, feel free to subscribe to our Patreon to get bonus episodes from Zar Power. As I mentioned, we have a merchandise store. You can get Tsar Power branded items. You can get our Olga of Kiev Tsarbucks logo and cups associated with it. But if you're like, hey, I don't want to actually buy merch, can I just get you a book or something? You can be like Eloise, who got us Domostroy, The Rules for Russian Households in Time of Ivan the Terrible, off our Amazon book wish list. You can get me more stuff. Because you know what I actually did? I finally used the Patreon dollars to get a book for the Patreon. So, but if you wanted to buy it for us directly, you can do that. You can use PayPal too. You can use Ko-fi. If you're like, what's the info? Ask me. I'm on the social medias. I will look at them if you message me. But if you're like, actually, Roberto, I don't want to spend money. How do I do something that's free? You can leave a 5-star review on your favorite podcast host, be it Apple, Spotify, Podcast Addict, Overcast, whatever you use, as long as it's 5 stars. Anything lower than that, we don't want.
If it's lower than 5 stars, keep it to yourself.
You can give us constructive criticism on our Gmail. And that's a do svidaniya, tovarishi from me.
Goodbye!
Warning! Radio Tsar Power is speaking. We have a very important message. Comrades and citizens of the Soviet Union, today, in the year, on the month and day of, we have received a few important questions. Comrade Aurora, may you read the questions, please?
Is there a difference between capitalism and communism?
In principle, yes. In capitalism, man exploits man. In communism, it's the reverse.
Is it true that there's freedom of speech in the Soviet Union, the same as there is in the USA?
In principle, yes. In the USA, you can stand in front of the Washington Monument in Washington, D.C. and yell, "Down with Trump!" and you will not be punished. In the Soviet Union, you can stand in the Red Square in Moscow and yell, "Down with Trump!" and you will not be punished.
Is it true that the poet Vladimir Mayakovsky committed suicide?
Yes, it is true. And even the record of his very last words is preserved. Don't shoot, comrades! This has been a Radio Tsar Power announcement. We hope to have made your stay a bit more enjoyable. See you at the Gulag.
Hey, History of Persia fans! Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East, the very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history, and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.